The piano was the woman's instrument. It was also the girl's instrument and part of their marriageability. And the cultural history of the piano is, well, it's a fascinating topic right around the world. But in Australia, it's been part of modern Australia. The first piano arrived on the first fleet. And as I mentioned earlier, it was at the gold fields, it was in the trenches, and these days they tend to be left unloved and ruined on rubbish tips around the country. We're going to talk about the subject of the rise and fall of the piano with two authors. One of them is Michael Atherton, Emeritus Professor from Western Sydney University, composer and performer. His book is called A Coveted Possession, The Rise and Fall of the Piano in Australia. And Virginia Lloyd's memoir is Girls at the Piano. We'll start, though, with the sound, well, the very sad sound, I always think, of a ruined piano, two ruined pianos in this case, played by Ross Bolitar. One of them is a Hans Richter, made in Berlin, probably the early 20th century, and J.B. Cramer piano from the mid-19th century from London. Their makers didn't expect them to sound like this. That's a little music from Ross Bolitar, one of his ruined piano pieces. That's the Red Way from his album Night Kitchen, an hour of ruined piano. And there's always something incredibly touching about listening to Ross's music. Well, as I said, we're going to be talking about pianos, the piano in Australia, the piano in the 19th and 20th century with those two authors, Michael Atherton and Virginia Lloyd. Virginia, maybe I'll start with you. What's your response to that sound?
I think it's absolutely beautiful. I love the percussiveness and the kind of the geometry of it. Field shapes, and yes, I think it's that percussive beauty that feels so deeply connected to the piano as the machine.
Yes,
from which it came.
But I always feel as though the history is sort of seeping out of the instrument as it's being strummed and plucked and bashed.
Seeping is maybe a little bit negative. I prefer to think of it as kind of floating free, being liberated in some way.
All right. Okay. Michael Atherton, I mean, it wasn't always like this, was it? The piano in Australia. An awful lot of pianos these days sound a bit like the one that Ross Bolitar was playing there. But once upon a time, there was a kind of proud tradition of the piano, which is really what your book, A Coveted Possession, is about. First of all, you make a fairly big claim that it's an important part of Australian history. And I wonder whether, you know, you could have written a book about the piano in Norway or the piano in Italy, and would it have been substantially different, or is there something specifically Australian about your story?
Well, I don't want to get caught up in definitions of nationalism, but if I use the word nation building, and I'd say I agree with you, yes, you could write about the piano in America, as many have done, and in Europe. But I think the essential difference here is the fact that many pianos were shipped. They were on clippers. They'd travel thousands of miles, as it was then, but often they were damaged when they arrived. And then their lives after they were here was very fraught. They became this absolute coveted possession, this desired object, this aspirational link to the mother country and to the culture of the German composer such as Handel et al. And as soon as we had a gold rush and there's money circulating, it was a no-brainer. You bought this. We didn't have a car then. So we needed this great machine that Virginia mentioned. That's what I hear in Ross's music. I hear the concatenation of the 12,000 parts on the piano that went to make this great iron ship of the 19th century. This great this great musical tool, which now goes to the tip in numbers every day.
Why the piano, though? As far as its musical uses are concerned, I mean, a guitar or a banjo or something would have done for singing. The piano has other qualities, presumably, Michael.
Well, it does. It's the sheer power of being able to put, you know, your 10 digits and get great clumps of sound or a single sound. And remember, it's tied to the development of sheet music and the capacity for amateurs to be able to experience great operas, to play around with Beethoven and to emulate, you know, Liszt. And once someone like Liszt was putting the piano solo on stage, everyone wanted it, just like you have 46 million Chinese children wanting to be the next Lang Lang. Mm. And the Pearl River Piano Company pouring them out, 300,000 a year plus and more. This is the new piano revolution, and in a way China is mirroring Australia. We have this great object that travelled, and suddenly people found you could make it here and you could make it last longer. And that was critical, because if you invest so much money in the centrepiece of the home, this great Victorian moralising object, the piano, from one aspect, or something you could really bash out some Irish jigs on, well, you did anything to buy it. You go into hock. And they did. Hire purchase really took off with the piano.
But as you say, the European piano wasn't built for Australian conditions, so it had to be acclimatised in a way.
I believe so. I mean, the iron frame certainly was the leveller, you know, and the Germans were quick to follow the makers in the United States. If you brought a wooden frame piano in, like an Erard or a Broadwood, the older pianos of France and England, they wouldn't last.
Yes.
Because of the exchange. People, Australians carry their pianos around, so you'd go from Tasmania to Cairns, and the chances of a piano surviving that are very slim.
1834, the first piano is made in Australia.
So it's just over the road here in Ultimo, in the Powerhouse Museum. May it long stay here, the museum and the piano.
You both write in your books very much about the piano in society and its role, and you both actually make reference to Jane Austen. Maybe we should talk about the way in which it works in a Jane Austen novel, not just Jane Austen, but particularly Jane Austen, where so many of the characters, the female characters, tend to play the piano. Because this, in a way, this is the kind of an important backdrop to your own story, it seems to me, Virginia.
Well, that's right, Andrew, and further to what Michael was saying, the piano was historically considered the most appropriate instrument for a young lady to learn on and play. It was definitely not welcomed, the idea of a woman playing a violin, for example, God forbid the cello. And so the piano was very much a site of a whole host of cultural and sexual associations, you know, and that's why you see in the Jane Austen novels a lot of the heroines of her fiction performing at varying degrees of, you know, technical facility for other people. They don't compete. That's certainly not something that that musical young women in the novels of Jane Austen would do. They would never compete, although they would not compete for a trophy, but trophy in the form of a husband.
But they're judged, aren't they?
But they're certainly judged. And so it's interesting, when you think about some of the most familiar musical characters in her novels, you think of Jane Fairfax, who is extremely proficient, but is
possibly too proficient.
Is possibly too proficient, according to the author, I suspect.
Yes.
And so she has a secret, and so she's not the sort of the moral centre of the work. And then you've got Mary Bennett,
Elizabeth's younger sister,
who gets a chance to play the piano and it sort of bores everybody to
She does. But also the music that Mary Bennett plays, it tends to be not, shall we say, high art. It tends to be airs and jigs. And actually there's I'm going to see if I can find, in Michael's book, there's a letter to the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. This is from 1843. Gentlemen, that's the editors of the Sydney Morning Herald, on my way to church last evening, I was much surprised to hear through the open window of a house not far from the bank of Australasia, but on the opposite side of the road, the notes of a piano on which some person was playing a common jig tune. I trust a little reflection will convince the person in question of the impropriety of such conduct from the tendency it has to set a bad example to the many idlers to be found in that part of the city, and also to distract the attention of those who are going to church from the serious thoughts that should occupy their minds. I am, gentlemen, your obedient servant, Mentor.
Oh, dear.
I mean, it's a very versatile instrument, the piano, isn't it?
Well,
and it
does.
Can play Liszt on the one hand, but it can also play jigs.
And Scottish reels. And you see that there's a lot of moral value in that statement. And it actually tells you a lot about class distinction in Pitt Street, Sydney and beyond, and the new housing areas. But I think there have been amazing revolutions in music, and I don't actually mention this in the book, but one thing that always strikes me as a major change in Europe is when suddenly Scott Joplin plays the piano and is published. There's a whole new development in Afro-American music, and the piano's at the centre of that. So that's just one anecdote to me that is about how it brings us to why the piano became so important.
Yes.
If you are, you know, the daughter of a Lithgow miner, and, you know, you would expect Dada to put some money aside to get you a piano, because that's what good, well-bred Victorian ladies did. They learned to play the piano and they were expected to entertain while Dad, you know, or hubby went to work.
My grandparents in England, in Liverpool, they lived in a two-up, two-down terrace, which was knocked down eventually. They didn't have a bathroom and they didn't have an inside toilet, but they had a piano.
Yeah.
And no one played it. There were no pianists in the family.
I was exactly the same. I was born in Liverpool. You can't hear the accent, but we had a two-up, two-down. Gran had a piano, was never played. And, you know, I talk in the book about how one day I used to visit her in Liverpool because I went to the posh side of the Mersey, I went to Cheshire, and I would pick out hymn tunes. Mm. And one day she raced in a pinafore, her hands covered in flour from, you know, preparing fish. And she said, "You can't do that," in her Irish Liverpool accent. I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "You can't play Protestant hymns on my piano." I thought, what am I doing here that's wrong? In later life, I laughed. But apparently, you know, she had opera records, but there was no music in my house. And yet the piano was central.
But it's
Grandpa didn't play it. My father never opened it.
But it's a piece of furniture, isn't it?
And it may be
a useless piece of furniture if nobody plays it. But it's there for that reason alone.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, it, like any piece of high technology, it was first acquired by the wealthiest families in Europe, and then it trickled That's down right. in terms of availability. It became more accessible to people with fewer resources, and as Michael said, the piano was the first thing to be able to. They invented the system of hire purchase to accommodate working class families wishing to buy a piano. Such was the demand.
Yes, so it's a ticket to respectability.
And people would hear it in the church because you couldn't always put a pipe organ in an Australian church. I mean, eventually you got a Mac, so you'd like a piano there, and it became this object that you stood around, sat around, put things on.
And it's also all music, just about all Western music can be accommodated on the piano, because you mentioned Scott Joplin. I mean, it's an important part of early rock and roll.
Yeah.
Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Johnston in Chuck Berry's band, and jazz as well. And there's a lovely line in Virginia's book about how your love of modern jazz was socially the equivalent of herpes.
I think a cold sore, actually.
I like it. But let us talk about your story, because you played the piano from an early age and you wanted to get good at it, and you did get good at it.
I did. I'm one of these terribly sort of goal-oriented people, so I pursued the exams and the grades and all of that sort of thing. But I genuinely did love playing the piano, and it was somewhere that I could safely and privately explore the world of sound. It was somewhere that I was left alone from family members, and it was somewhere where I felt confident in a way that I felt less confident, you know, away from the piano stool, the girls' school I attended and that sort of thing. I just loved it, and I had a facility for accompanying other instrumentalists and vocalists, and I just really enjoyed it. Just kept on going until I lost confidence and I lost I lost the sense that it was possible for me to pursue a professional life with music. I had a teacher who was pushing me, but he was very much pushing me along the predestined paths of, you know, the AMEB exams and that, you know, that sort of formal path and the repertoire. And so I guess I got to a point where, even though my admiration and respect for the music I was studying as a piano student had never been higher, but my passion for music was going in a different direction. I was drawn increasingly to improvisation and jazz-based music and lots of different sorts of sounds. And instead of being honest about that and talking to the teacher about it or reaching out for other ways to participate, I just kind of stepped away from it.
But you sort of collided with Chopin first, didn't you?
That's the, yes,
you
that would
crashed
be.
Crashed into the Revolutionary Etude.
Yeah, we had an almighty crash on stage at the Opera House in an Estedford competition. So I was, it was really my last hurrah in competition. Prior to the event, I'd started to develop some tightness in my forearm when practicing the Revolutionary Etude, which, as you both know, requires some pretty intense work of the right hand, with consequential, you know, octaves and cluster chords and so forth. It came and went. It progressively worse, but by the time of the competition, I thought, well, I'll just kind of tough it out. I'm sure I can control this tightness. And I got into the venue and there were probably about 12 competitors. They were all wearing their Sydney Conservatorium of Music High School uniforms on a hot Saturday afternoon. And I thought, uh-oh. And the first couple played and they just were astoundingly technically proficient and at a much higher level than I had reached at that time. And I thought, wow, okay, this is really telling me I have reached the end of the line here, and that's okay, you know. But I thought, I'm going to do my best. I know this work really, really well. We're all playing from memory, and as is also the convention, for better and for worse. And I got up there and there were these huge, the stage lights were shining right on me. I felt this very cold sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach as I set out to play, and no sooner had I set my fingertips on the keyboard than the tightness came into my forearm and it just really froze in such a way that my right arm just traveled down the keyboard like a car careening out of control and just this hail of notes, and it was just diabolically humiliating. And, you know, but good old goal-oriented me, I actually persevered to the end of the piece, much to everyone's horror, I'm sure, and got up, bowed, and then scurried away before everyone could sort of freely burst into tears. I could burst into tears and they could burst into laughter, I guess.
Well, no, but look, that brings me to something else which you write about, Michael. I mean, you could devote some of your book to discussing famous Australian pianists, and there have been some very famous Australian pianists, and amongst them, some rather sad stories of people who are, you know, dysfunctional at one level or another. And I'm thinking of people like Noel Newton Wood, for instance, Geoffrey Tozer, yeah, David Helfgott. And is there something about the business of being a performer up there on stage in front of a piano, alone on stage with a big audience out there waiting for you? I mean, there's a kind of gladiatorial aspect, it seems to me, to playing the piano. It's you versus it.
I can't speak directly from experience, but I can only surmise this, having researched and feeling it when, you know, I've played solo guitar and lute pieces. But if you think of the welter of expectation, you know, Liszt opens the lid, puts the piano at the front of the stage. Suddenly it's the first time in Western music history on a giant stage, big auditorium, there is a piano waiting and a pianist comes out. There's so much power and expectation. And it must be incredibly lonely if you don't get it right. If there's an orchestra there, you've got a little bit of backing and leeway, but, you know, that being able to just go out, and the demons must be there. You know, does it attract people with, you know, with some emotional difficulties. I suspect it's people pushing themselves to the edge, knowing just how much work you have to do to be great, to play the great repertoire. It is tragic when you look at the way people dealt with it. I mean, our dear old Percy, I think he would get stage fright, and he used to do things like run off the stage and come back again for a bit of fun. He was so athletic. Eileen Joyce would change her costume. She loved Norman Hartnell. She would change every concerto.
Yes, there's a story of her playing four concertos in one concert, which is in itself amazing, but there's a different frock for each piece.
So she had her own kind of synesthetic view of her music. She had colours for Rachmaninoff and Chopin. I mean, she was a legend, and Australians don't really know about her. And the first thing the Australian journalist did when she arrived back was ask her about her dresses. Didn't realise she was the talk of England. But poor Noel Newton Wood, I mean, you know, living at a time when he had a relationship with his best mate, he died. And so after an appendix operation, poor Noel killed himself. And Noel was a really close friend of Benjamin Britten. And yet people don't know about the quality of this musician.
No, but there are some recordings, and he was a wonderful pianist.
Yeah, it's a difficult life. I mean, you know, you look at someone like Roger Woodward, who moves between playing in great concert halls and will play the theatre, you know, the old theatre in Glen Innes or something.
Mm,
I mean, it's a long life on the road, and you can't really have a family. You really are living, you know, that is your family.
And it's ironic, isn't it? Because here we are, we're talking about the most domestic of instruments.
Mm.
It's been good to talk to you both about the piano. Virginia Lloyd is the author of Girls at the Piano, and Michael Atherton is the author of A Coveted Possession, The Rise and Fall of the Piano in Australia. And we should hear Roger Woodward, I think, since you've mentioned him. And if you don't mind, Virginia, we'll hear him play Chopin's Revolutionary Etude.
Great.